different understanding of the universe. I think we, in many ways, certainly at a scientific level, have a more developed understanding of the universe. Whether we're any wiser or not is another issue. Just because we're more modern doesn't necessarily make us any wiser with the added information we have. But we want, here at Student Rich, we want to wrestle with those things, right? We want to look at perhaps traditional interpretations and challenge those, but not be disrespectful to the past and how the followers of Jesus have approached these stories over the years. So we want to be in that sort of tension, that place of tension, that place of challenge. And I think what we're doing as we do that, what we're finding is that these stories are very deep and complex. They're about more than just the miracle itself. They're symbolic and representative of big issues to do with the human condition and the kind of healing that Jesus was bringing, not just to individuals, but to humanity as a whole. Now today, we're going to look at a resurrection story, a story where Jesus brings back a friend of his, Lazarus, to life after Lazarus had died, 4 days after he died, in fact. And we're going to read that story in a moment. But as we think about that issue of resurrection, I think this is one that's very emotive for us, right? When we think about people coming back to life, that really appeals to us because, firstly, probably we all know that we're going to die or are expecting that we're going to die, and that is somewhat of a fearful thing, right? That's part of our human condition, our mortality, our sense of frailty, and the thought of coming back to life or not dying is very appealing to us. Not only that, we've all experienced loss and pain from people close to us who have died, maybe died untimely deaths or unjust deaths, or just died and we miss them so desperately. So the thought of bringing someone back to life, that's a kind of miracle that I think appeals to us. Same with like healings. I think those really appeal to us. If we were to think about a universe, a reality, where those things happened, we would like that kind of reality. I think other miracles of Jesus probably, speak to us or appeal to us less. You know, there's a story in Matthew's Gospel where Jesus pays the temple tax by telling Peter to go out and catch a fish, open its mouth, and there's a coin in there. I'm not sure that if we think about the reality we want, is that as important to us? Or walking on water, I mean, is that really important to us? It might come in handy at times, but it's not necessarily that important to us. We wouldn't necessarily put that down on the top five things that we want the universe to be like. Or another example of that would be turning water into wine, right? Now, that might be useful, but it would be very abused, right? We'd abuse that if that's was our reality, we'd probably abuse that. But I think you see what I'm getting at here, that some of Jesus's miracles are not ones that we're necessarily seeing as, oh, Jesus means we should go and do that. That's how life should be. But I think sometimes when it comes to things like healing and people being raised from the death, from the dead, we want life to be like that. We wish it was. Okay, so it speaks to us deeply. That, however, and we talked about tensions just a second ago, that's in tension with the fact that we know somehow deep within us, fundamentally, that death is a natural part of life. Right? We know that, for instance, you know, just imagine if nobody ever died again, or from the time of Jesus, nobody ever died, we'd have some problems, right? We'd have a population problem of some kind. We know that death is just a normal part of the universe. Stars are born and die. Matter and energy is recycled. Even within our own planet, we're going to approach fall soon, where leaves will fall off the leaves and fall off the trees and die, and they'll be recycled, and that energy will bring life back to the earth in other forms. When it comes to things like, has anybody ever got strep throat? Right? Okay, the streptococcus. We try to kill that thing all the time, right? Because in some sense, some things have to die in order that other things might live, right? That's part of our reality. So we also understand that death is part of life. It's just that we don't really understand it and we're afraid of it. And not only that, I think when we think about the kind of issues Jesus is talking about when these miracles happen, or when he tells stories or talks about life, somehow our deepest understandings or our deepest experience of life are in some of the most deathly moments of our lives, right? In the darkest times, in the pain and the loss and the grief. I'm not in any way trying to celebrate those things or say that we all should all seek those out. But I think we can all reflect on our own lives. I know I can in mine, that it's in the difficult times, the times of loss, the times of hardship, the times that feel like death. Somehow that's where life is. That's where I change the most. That's where I'm transformed. That's where I understand more about what life means, and perhaps more about what the richness of life that Jesus talked about really means. I don't know whether you can relate to that or not. So we can't just brush death aside as something that, well, Jesus means nobody should ever die from now on, right? So as we read this story, what we're going to do, Jennifer's going to read it to us, and we're going to just reflect on it a bit. It's quite a long story, so I encourage you just to sort of get into reflection mode, kind of soak it up. There's a bit of context at the beginning and a bit more context at the end, and we'll sort of chat a little bit about that afterwards. But soak this story up, and then we're going to try and look at, what does this miracle mean? What is it saying to us? How is it challenging us? How do we apply it to our own lives? Let's listen to the story.
Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days, and then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." After she said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. "What are we accomplishing?" they asked. "Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation." Then one man named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than for the whole nation to perish." He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for the nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up to the country, from the country to Jerusalem, for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood there in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it, so that they might arrest him.
Thanks, Jennifer. So the reason we read that whole passage, that's a whole chapter from John, rather than just the story about Lazarus coming back from the dead, is just to give it a little bit of context, because I think we get there a feel for the book of John, this Gospel of John, where this story occurs in general. We get a kind of a feel for it. The story itself, you know, is full of pathos, right? But it's full of contradiction and tension as well. You know, we have this wonderful story of Jesus raising Lazarus, but the irony is that because Jesus brings somebody back from the dead, the religious authorities want to kill him. And so, you know, that sort of end part of the story there is all about the plot to kill Jesus. And this is a transition in the book of John into the passion story, the story of Jesus's death and resurrection. So, it's at that kind of turning point. The book of John is one of the four gospels, right, that we have in our Christian scriptures, the New Testament, as we call it. And it's very different to the other gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which are called the synoptic gospels. That just means seen together. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke can be seen together. They're very similar stories. Most scholars would assume that or suggest that Mark was written first, and then Matthew and Luke have kind of based their account on Mark's account, added in some of their own material and some joint material. And in those three Gospels, I mean, word for word in the original language, there are huge passages that are identical. You know, just identical in the Greek. So there's a similarity to them. John's Gospel is very different. We believe it was written quite a bit later than those other Gospels. Probably has some understanding or some knowledge of those other Gospels. But it's written in a time where the Christian movement, if you like, the movement that was following Jesus, which originated as a movement within Judaism, is beginning to experience deep conflict with Judaism, and there's a separation taking place. So John's Gospel is really full of this sense of conflict, and we hear some of that in that story we just read, right, about the people that are rejecting Jesus. You know, and that would have, to the readers at that time, that would have been very significant. They were experiencing that same kind of rejection. So it's full of that. It's full of theological discourse on who is Jesus. Why do we believe Jesus to be the Messiah? Why are we following Jesus? Why is it worth dealing with this conflict and this rejection in order to follow Jesus? I mean, Jesus must be significant then. And so John's Gospel can be divided into two halves, really, or two sections, with a prologue and an epilogue at the end. But two essential sections. One, what's known as the Book of Signs. There are seven signs, seven miracles that Jesus works. This is the seventh one. That then have all kinds of discussion around them. So, which we noted in this story, right? It's not just the miracle. There's some discussion before. There's some discussion during. Jesus sort of prays this strange prayer where it says editorially, he didn't pray that prayer for his own benefit. He prayed it so that the people around him could hear it. In other words, everything Jesus does and says is an explanation of these signs, an explanation of who Jesus is and what Jesus is about. So we have the Book of Signs, and then what's known as the Book of Glory, which is like Jesus' final discourses with his followers, his death, his resurrection. So, and the sense there is that Jesus is glorified, that Jesus embodies this divine life, this beautiful life, this rich life. Like Jesus embodies life to all its dimensions. You may remember at the beginning of this series, we talked about the fact that these miracles point to the fact that there's more to life than meets the eye. That's certainly true in John's Gospel. These signs are saying there's more to life than meets the eye. There's more to life than this material world. Language like the kingdom of God or the divine life or which is embodied in the love of Jesus. This love consciousness, if you will, which sounds a bit like it should be a Donna Summer song as I say that, you know. But I think you get what I mean. It's this sense of Jesus really living the divine life as it really can be. And that's the, if you like, the glorification of Jesus. So we when we read this story, we're reading it in that kind of context, right? This context that Jesus, we're seeing here who Jesus is with some explanations about that. And we're getting this sense of that Jesus is wanting us to live this resurrected life, okay? And that would have obviously been very encouraging to the followers of Jesus at that time when John is written, because they're wrestling with all these issues. So there's a little bit of context there from the book of John. What about Lazarus and Mary and Martha? So we've got this family, Mary and Martha, who might sound familiar figures. There's a little passage in Luke's Gospel where Mary and Martha, Martha's the sort of the workaholic, the one who wants to serve all the time, and Mary's the one who sat at Jesus' feet and seems more reflective and perhaps more contemplative, and there's a sort of a, you know, they seem like opposites, and Jesus has this really beautiful interaction with them both. But there's no mention of them having a brother, Lazarus. In the next chapter, actually, Mary, so in chapter 12 in John's Gospel, Mary washes Jesus' feet and wipes them with her hair. And that story appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well. But it's never pointed out that it's Mary. She's never named. And it's a very different context. In Matthew and Mark, it's in the house of Simon the leper. In Luke, it's in the house of Simon the Pharisee. You know, so this is what the Gospel writers do. They take different stories and use them in different ways to make different points. Now, there is a story about Lazarus, though. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is Mary and Martha, we're not exactly sure who they are. We're not exactly sure who Lazarus is, but we do have a story about Lazarus. We're going to look at that in a second. But actually, let's look at it now. In Luke's Gospel, chapter 16, he's a fictitious character, right? He's a character in a story that Jesus tells. But interestingly, it's a story about life after death. It's a story about life that transcends death. So let's look at this story. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angel carried him to Abraham's side. That means Abraham's bosom. And I remember as a kid, my mother trying to explain to me that when we die, we go to Abraham's bosom. And I was totally grossed out by that. It really kind of put me off. But there's a lot of symbolic language here, okay, in this story that Jesus is telling. It's clearly not literal. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, that's the Greek underworld, right? So, yeah, we've got sort of Abraham's bosom. That's a very Hebrew kind of notion of the afterlife. We've got a Greek notion of the afterlife. So, you know, I would doubt any of us actually would sort of take these kinds of things literally when we think about the afterlife. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have 5 brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." Okay, so that's the story. Now, you know, we have here, I think, you know, an application to the story of John that we read about in John, right? It may be, and we, as I said earlier, Luke, the writing of Luke precedes the writing of John. It may be that the writer, or probably more likely the writers of the Gospel of John, are taking this story and using it in a more literal sense. That clearly Jesus doesn't mean that literally. You know, it's a parable. But they're using it and applying it into their own situation. Now, I don't think that necessarily means we shouldn't take the story of John of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead literally. That may well have happened. But I think if we're looking for meaning, this passage in Luke is very interesting, because it's saying a couple of things. It's saying that if somebody comes back from the dead, you wouldn't believe them anyway, right? In John's, we know that was the case for Jesus, right? So that Jesus comes back from the dead, and very few people believe it. In the case of the story in John, even Lazarus coming back from the dead, so it's like the literal fulfillment of this parable. Lazarus does come back, the writers of John are making a very clear point that they still wanted to kill Jesus. This person coming back from the dead doesn't make any difference whatsoever. And this, you know, that story in Luke is just sort of classic Luke description of Jesus, because Jesus is in Luke is this great prophet, and Jesus is constantly saying, "You never believed the prophets, and you're not probably going to believe me. And even if I come back from the dead, you're not going to believe me." You know, that was a frequent message of Jesus's. So, the gospel writers of John seem to be taking this story and applying it into the situation. So, what we have from this, then, perhaps, when we think about what this miracle might mean, and we just said that, you know, earlier. Okay, probably we are not meant to interpret this miracle as, oh, Jesus doesn't want any of us to die ever again, physically. But rather, there's a resurrection. I wonder if what this means is there's a resurrection life. There's a life that transcends death, but is not just about living physically forever. It's more than that. It's about this divine life that Jesus was talking about, this real life, this life to the full, or abundant life, if you like, that Jesus described in John. This is an encouragement. This story, then, is an encouragement to those who believe Jesus that the resurrected life is possible. It's possible to live this life that Jesus offers. And secondly, it's an encouragement that some are going to reject it. I mean, maybe that's not very encouraging. It's perhaps more of a challenge that some are going to reject it. So I think we can sort of take those two challenges, right? What does the resurrected life mean? What does resurrection mean? When Jesus says, "I am the resurrection," in what way does he embody resurrected life? In what way does he embody eternal life? And secondly, in what way might we be holding back from that? You know, there's so much more, as we've said. You know, miracles point to so much more. So in what way might we be holding back from really living this resurrected life? So we're going to just look at those two questions, and then we'll try and, you know, apply them specifically to our own lives. So the first one, what is this life that Jesus is talking about? What is it all about? And I just want to look at four brief passages from elsewhere in John's Gospel, because this is all about what Jesus was communicating. Firstly, he describes it as oneness in the Father, with the Father. Let's look at chapter 10. "I and the Father are one." Again, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus said to them, "I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these do you stone me?" So there's that rejection again. "We are not stoning you for any good work," they replied, "but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God." Jesus answered them, "Is it not written in your law, 'I have said, you are gods'? If he called them gods, to whom the word of God came, and scripture cannot be set aside, what about the one whom the Father set apart as his very own and sent into the world? Why then do you accuse me of blasphemy because I said, 'I am God's son'? Do not believe me unless I do the works of my Father. But if I do them, even though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father." Again, they tried to seize him, but he escaped their grasp. I think we're getting a pattern here that this truth that Jesus is talking, this reality that he's describing, is both beautiful, but it's also terrifying. They're rejecting it. There's a couple of ways of looking at Jesus, right? One is that Jesus is God sent to humanity to save humanity. Another way is of looking at Jesus, certainly in John's Gospel, is that Jesus is a man who is experiencing oneness with God, who is experiencing this divine life. And not only that, invites us to experience the same thing. I think that's what Jesus is getting at here when he talks about, even the scriptures say, "You shall be gods." I don't think that means that there's a chance I might turn out to be a god. I think what it means is there's a chance I might be able to experience divine life, real life. And there's a chance I might be able to experience life to the fullest dimension in the way that Jesus experienced life. Let's look at another passage. Well, this is just one verse. In chapter 12, it says, "And I," this is Jesus talking, "when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." So Jesus seems to be invited somehow through Jesus' death, because this seems to be a reference to his death. It could mean sort of him being lifted up on the cross, right? And that's a traditional interpretation. I wonder if he also means that if I am lifted up in the sort of theology of John, if I am glorified, if I rise to this higher plane of love. And what's the greatest expression of love? Well, it's letting go of your life, right? It's laying your life down. If I'm raised to that higher plane, you will be able to participate in the same kind of life. You'll be able to participate in this resurrected life. And you'll be able to participate, if you like, and this sounds such hippy-dippy language, but God consciousness, if you think, like, or the love consciousness, this new way of being, let alone thinking or seeing or doing. And we're invited into that. Okay, so we participate in that resurrected life. Jesus is the resurrection. We participate in it through Jesus, right? Now, let's look at another one. In John chapter 17, it says, "My prayer," and these are probably familiar because we talk about these a lot, I think, here. "My prayer is not for them alone," Jesus praying here. "I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity." Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. So here's Jesus saying, not only, okay, Jesus experienced this oneness with God, this divine life. Jesus invites us to participate in that with him. We are drawn to him. We are resurrected with him. But not only that, we are drawn into, as that happens, we are drawn into oneness with one another. This love consciousness, this new way of being is oneness with God, but oneness with humanity, where the barriers between us are broken down, right? Where the divisions, the hatred, the strife, the conflict, the difficulties, the human condition is healed, if you like. Okay, this is all very, I know I'm speaking very idealistically and in idealistic terms, but here's the reality. Jesus seems to be inviting us into that kind of an ideal. In John chapter 14, he says this, "Very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these, because I am going to the Father." In other words, because of my oneness, because of my embodiment of the divine life, because of me embodying resurrection, that kind of life we just talked about then is possible. So we're talking about potential for humanity that I think just far outweighs anything we've possibly experienced or imagined. And Jesus is offering that. Jesus is saying, this is real. This is possible. And he's inviting us into it. I think this is what the story of Lazarus is encouraging us about and challenging us about. It's an invitation into the resurrection. It's an invitation into real life, divine life. Now, Jesus is very emotional in this story, right? We see Jesus getting emotional in numerous occasions in the Gospels. This is a great example of it. In John chapter 11, so this is from the story we just read about Lazarus. It says, when Jesus saw her weeping, that's one of Lazarus's sisters, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Okay, he's deeply moved. That word in the Greek means he snorts with anger. That doesn't kind of sound so well in the English text. It describes the flaring of the nostrils, right? So it's a very emotive term, but it's got this kind of tinge of anger to it. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. That's the shortest verse in the Bible, that one. Jesus wept. So he's moved with compassion, one assumes. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. They're concluding that Jesus is weeping because Lazarus is dead. But some of them said, could he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Jesus once more, so they're challenging him, you know. Jesus once more, deeply moved, flaring of the nostrils, snorting with anger, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Okay, so what we have there, just in the ending, I think, the stone laid across the entrance. What does that sound like? That sounds like the story we're about to hear in the ending of John, which is the passion story, the story of Jesus. And John is quite, the writers of John are quite careful in the way they tell this story about Lazarus and the way they tell the story about Jesus. We have some discussion questions that accompany the messages throughout this series, and you can get a copy of those out on the table in the lobby or download them online. And one of the questions this week encourages you just to look at the Lazarus story, compare it to the Jesus resurrection story. We're not going to look at that specifically right now. That's an interesting comparison, but I'll point out a couple of things. Well, there's the stone issue, but you know, that's how people were buried back in those days. But it's interesting, do you notice when Lazarus comes out of the tomb, it says he had the cloth still wrapped around him. Actually, it says his hands and his feet were bound and his head was, he had the cloth around his head. Well, that's different to the kind of resurrection that Jesus experienced, right? Jesus' resurrection is more than just a physical resurrection. It's not, and there's elements to it that are described very physically, like people touching Jesus, Jesus eats, Jesus bears the scars of his crucifixion. But Jesus also kind of appears out of nowhere in a room. He disappears into nowhere when he's breaking bread with people. So this resurrection of Jesus transcends the physical realm. It's bigger. It's more holistic. It's fuller in every sense than this resuscitation of a dead body. So, you know, Lazarus here is a dead body that's come back to life. That's the way it's described. And he's still got the clothes on him, and it's because he's going to die again. You know, Lazarus will die again eventually. This is foreshadowing of Jesus' resurrection, but it's we're getting a hint here of the largesse of the resurrection of Jesus. But also in this passage here of emotion, we see Jesus getting really stirred up, and that begs the question: what is he angry about? What is he weeping over? And I think what we see here is the kind of urgency and the intensity with which Jesus is sharing about or offering real life, this divine life. It's not just, hey, do you want this? Do you want a helping hand in life? This is, do you want to change everything? Do you want to turn the universe upside down? There's a sense of enormity to this. And I think Jesus is feeling every ounce of compassion as a human being in that situation. I'm sure loss about Lazarus. I'm sure feeling for somebody, who, you know, his sisters who are grieving. So Jesus is fully engaged in this reality. But he's also, I think, angry that we're still bound by the confines of this reality that we've taken on ourselves, or that he's angry that we can't break out and experience this fuller reality, this fuller sense of love and unity with God and unity with one another. He has a dream for humanity, if you like. He has a vision for humanity that transcends all that. And it's really interesting in the text, I don't know whether you notice, Jesus says, when Lazarus comes out, Jesus says, untie him. And that's the same word, luo, that we heard last week, you know, when Jesus was untying the woman who was bent over, crippled, with back problems. Jesus is wanting to set us free. Jesus is wanting to open our minds, open our hearts, give us a new understanding of what life can really be like. And I think Jesus is, it feels very emotional to Jesus. So how can we respond? What can we do then in response to this ideal, right? To this this vision for humanity? I want to look at three things, right? I always figure if it's three things, that makes it a good message, right? Because, you know, that's the tradition. Covers up a whole load of rubbish that's gone before. Anyway, the people's perspective, the Jesus perspective and the Lazarus perspective. So as we think about these challenges, as always we think about this passage, let's kind of like feel the challenge that in certain parties within all this would have experienced. So the people's perspective, are we holding back from God? I mentioned earlier, I think this story is written really as a challenge to people who are saying, who are rejecting Jesus or resisting Jesus. And so the question is, to what degree are we resisting Jesus? Now, we're all here at church on a Sunday morning, so that might sound like a crazy question. But I don't know if you're anything like me, but I feel like I kind of live and practice two kinds of religion. In one form of my religion, one form of my faith, if you like, is I want Jesus to help me live a better life. Help me through some difficulties, you know, because life is difficult, life is hard, and I need as much help as I can get, and I want to be a good person, I want to be a better person, and I want Jesus to help me through, and I hope that when my life runs out, that there's something more beyond that, right? That's one way in which I think day to day, that's my reality. I'm just being honest about it, okay? But I think there's another reality, and I kind of flirt with this. I long for it, but I'm also afraid of it. And that is this, what if I totally let go of everything? What if I sought and, you know, sought after this life that Jesus is talking about? What if I was to let go? What if I was to do what Jesus did? Live a life where I'm not worried about wealth or prestige or what people think about me, where I'm not afraid to address my own problems, let go of my addictions and my habits and my defense mechanisms. I'm not afraid to engage in some of my difficult relationships and seek to bring healing, because with the full understanding that that might make things worse or might not work out well for me. Think of all the different ways in which we hold back on life. Did Jesus come just to kind of make things a little bit better, to make life bearable for us? Is that what the divine life's about? Or is it about a life that where we experience oneness with God and where the barriers between us are broken down? So I know I'm holding back. I don't know about you, but I know I am. And that I can think of certain specific areas in my life where I'm conscious of it. And it's the opposite of love. It's fear. I'm afraid. I'm just afraid to let go that much. You know, because I feel that there's other ways that I can control that are going to make me happy and make my life more meaningful. But Jesus is inviting us into a different kind of life. Right, so I think I would imagine that's a challenge for all of us. Right, in what ways are we holding back? Secondly, from the Jesus perspective, are we engaged with humanity? We've just seen Jesus' emotion and connection to people. We've also talked about the fact that this God consciousness, this divine life Jesus is talking about, is it's one in which we are one. We are all one. Where we let the barriers go down, where the divisions between us are lost. And again, what keeps us from doing that? What keeps us from experiencing that oneness with one another? I think it's fear of loss, right? You think about it at an individual level. What if we just shared everything we have? What if we were just open with one another? What about at a societal level, at a corporate level? What if we were to truly engage, empathize with people who are different from us and hear and feel their story, which is different to ours, and validate their story in a way that might feel very uncomfortable to us? We tend to shy away from that kind of stuff, right? What if we were to engage with people who are different from us and try and help people and get blamed for things and maybe even see how we're implicated in some of the problems? Like, you know, some of the hardest acts of healing to do are ones where we try to engage in either a relationship or maybe an issue in society where we're part of the problem, and we inevitably are, right? So it's painful, it's difficult, and we shy away from those kinds of things. So in what way are we disengaged with humanity? In what way are we just kind of keeping our safe distance? And then thirdly, the Lazarus perspective. This is kind of just, I suppose, more on a personal, practical level, but what needs resurrecting in us? I mean, in what way, this is kind of links back, I guess, to the first point. In what way have we checked out? In what way have we perhaps backed away from ideals? What way have we let go of dreams? In what way have we sort of compromised and come to a point where we're saying, I'm just going to get by. I'm going to settle for that first kind of religion that I was talking about earlier. And I'm just going to get by. And in all of this, and with Jesus' emotion around it, I don't think this should come to us as pressure, right? As you better follow the way of Jesus. You better, you know. And sometimes you can read the book of John actually almost in a divisive way, where it's like blaming people or accusing people who don't get Jesus. I don't think Jesus comes like that. Jesus comes as, you know, in Matthew 11, it says, Jesus said, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest. I'm not going to put more pressure on you. You know, hitch your wagon to mine. I'll come along with me. I'll help you." So this is a process of followership, right? It's a process of, it doesn't happen just like that. But I think these challenges are real challenges for all of us, I'm sure. Again, they're in the discussion questions. You can have some sort of conversations with others about that. But let's just sit with these for a little bit. And we're going to have communion. So, you know, we do this every week. There's gluten-free crackers and fruit juice at the front here and in the middle, where you can serve one another and you can be served at the sides. So this is a sort of contemplative, reflective time for us. And I would just sit with these questions for a little bit. You may not want to come up for communion straight away. That's fine. Or you might feel you want to do that and then reflect. But let's sit with these challenges and feel these challenges. Nobody's pointing the finger. But let's see it as this, that when Jesus broke the bread and poured the wine all that time ago with his followers, he's letting go of everything. He's going to his death. But he's imagining a future beyond our wildest dreams. He's imagining a unity for humanity that isn't based on policies and dictated by rulers, but where we're just naturally together. That sounds so idealistic, but I really think that is the dream of Jesus, that this hope for humanity, that it need not always be like this. So we're kind of celebrating that imagination, that dream, but it's hugely challenging. So it's kind of like this celebration and a feeling of challenge at the same time. Remember that you can also